Ukraine war to overcharge for gas. After the Ukraine conflict, the EU was forced to start importing LNG from the US as well as other countries. But the US's share had increased sharply from 28 to 45%. On the other hand, deliveries from Russia dropped by 75%. But this statement from the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, shows that France may have caught on to the US role in the Ukraine conflict. Le Maire recently told French MPs that the conflict in Ukraine must not result in the US economic domination and a weakened Europe. This is while the economy minister, Robert Habeck from Germany, accused LNG exporters, including the US, of charging too much for gas at the time when Europe's biggest economy is struggling to balance its energy mix without Russian supplies, and when German companies are closing down factories due to high gas costs. Electricity cuts in the UK and emergency gas rationing in Germany are just a couple of signs of how European leaders are sacrificing their country in order to defeat Russia and the less threat that they face from it. As for their economies, Europe has already slipped into a recession, and there are no signs that it can devise a plan that would lower energy costs to pre-Ukraine conflict levels in order to save their economies.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David Agreement in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then US President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests, which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' right to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first time Israel attempted to make the smallest bit of compromise was at the Camp David summit in 2000. Israel said it would be willing to allow 100,000 Palestinian refugees back to their homeland, while the millions of others had to be resettled wherever they were at the time. Also, Yasser Arafat, then chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, would have to forego the idea of right of return completely from then on. Similar ludicrous proposals that were rejected by Arafat were all proposed with the US being on board with these proposals. The US involvement in the so-called peace talks have time and again shown Palestinians and their officials that the US is not to be trusted as a neutral party. On the sidelines of the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia in Kazakhstan, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In it, he expressed that he is happy with Russia's position on Palestine. He also said that he would only accept U.S. involvement in the conflict resolution process if other parties of the Quartet on the Middle East were present. The Middle East Quartet, established in Madrid in 2002, is a foursome of nations and international and supranational entities involved in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. Its members are the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia. Palestine's hand is now one of unity, since the Palestinian factions have all established peace amongst themselves, including Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian factions signed reconciliation agreements in Algeria. Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year after the successful talks held in Algiers. Meanwhile, when it comes to peace talks between Israel and Palestine, Abbas has stressed that Washington should not be given free hand to act alone in resolving the decades-long Palestine-Israeli conflict.
Rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled its long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and his predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order. The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first. Whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar.
Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. He was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, with his talents, his genius, and his great endless scientific ability, has proven the luminous reality adopted by the Shia that an Imam must be the most aware and virtuous one of the people of his time. And it has also proven that the one who has more knowledge than anyone else must be the Imam, regardless of whether he is young or old. Allah the Almighty has provided the infallible Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, with knowledge, wisdom, and sound judgment, similar to how Allah provided the prophets of the past with these same concepts and qualities. Truly, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam has shown this reality to all of the world.
Parts of Ziyara texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. We find that in the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, with his companions, with his friends, with his relatives, with his family members, and with the people in general, he spoke quite a bit about Tawheed, Islamic monotheism. And of course, in an age where philosophical thoughts and theological opinions were being imported and infiltrated into the pure Muhammadan Islam. It was truly the endeavors and hard work and efforts of the Imams, including Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, that saved and preserved the pure Muhammadan Islam. And so we see that it was very important for Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam to pay special attention to these matters of the oneness of Allah. Of course, we had seen what the Jewish people had done to the original Judaism and what the Christians did to the original teachings of Jesus Christ. And so perhaps in order to avoid falling into those traps, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam speaks in depth about the oneness of Allah. And so in one such conversation regarding Islamic monotheism and Tawheed, we find that Muhammad bin Isa asked Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, "I imagine something." Now, Muhammad bin Isa was talking about imagining Allah. And so he said, "I imagine something." Interestingly, before Muhammad bin Isa could continue forwards and say something else, at that point, right then and there, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said to Muhammad bin Isa, "Yes, but Allah is not perceivable or limited. That which comes to your imagination is different from Allah. Nothing is like Allah, and imaginations cannot perceive Allah. For He is unlike whatever can be imagined by the mind." And so here we find, interestingly, that this is such a beautiful way to describe the oneness of Allah and to describe the attributes and the essence and the being of Allah. And this relates to the very present day as well. There are perhaps many of us who try to imagine what Allah is like. Now, this is a mistake because He cannot be perceived. Allah cannot be perceived. How can you imagine something in your mind which technically is unimaginable? Because our imagination cannot encompass and fully understand that which is Allah, the Supreme Being, the Constant Being, the only independent existence in all of existence. And so the more we try to imagine, perhaps the more we will become confused. So the only way out is for us to try to understand Allah based upon the teachings of the Qur'an and based upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And in that manner, will we be able to attain and reach true Tawheed, true Islamic monotheism. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth Imam. What is zinat? Beauty. But let us go to the hadith of the Imam, where Imam talks about a zinat in a very different level. وَالْحِفْظْ زِينَةُ الرِّوَايَةِ or زِينَةُ الرَّاوِيَةِ. In Islam, you know, riwayat, narrations are part of our life. And this is where memory becomes very important. So those who are in this process of learning the ahadith and the narrations, for them, the beauty is in the ability to memorize those ahadith. And this by itself is actually an art. You know, people learn how to do that. When you look at the people who have memorized the whole Quran, it's not a small book. But they're able to, you know, memorize the whole, you know, book. This needs a tutor, you know, to learn the method of how to do it. And even when it comes to hadith, there were many, many muhaddiseen. You will see with their names, they would sometimes be called al-hafiz so-and-so. They were not only hafiz of Quran, they were also hafiz of the hadith.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, Fi Amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump sought to cut a deal with the National Archives to trade records he took from the White House to Mar-a-Lago late last year for sensitive documents about the FBI investigation of his 2016 campaign ties to Russia, according to the New York Times. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Salon.com has more on this story. Former President Donald Trump sought to cut a deal with the National Archives to trade records he took from the White House to Mar-a-Lago late last year for sensitive documents about his alleged 2016 campaign ties to Russia. The exchange never happened, but Donald Trump floated the idea to his aides. The National Archives had pressed Donald Trump to return the documents stored at his Florida estate at Mar-a-Lago, but Trump spent a year and a half delaying their requests. He was upset with the National Archives' unwillingness to hand over the documents that ostensibly backed his claims in the Russia probe, according to the New York Times. Upon entering the White House, Donald Trump formed a habit of bringing documents back to his bedroom, according to the report. Halfway through his term in office, tracking files in the White House became an obstacle, and by his third year in office, some documents ended up in places where they should not have been, according to individuals familiar with the situation who spoke to the New York Times. At the end of his presidency, White House counsel Pat Cipollone called for Donald Trump to return documents that had piled up in boxes in the White House, according to archives officials, the New York Times reported. The top lawyer for the National Archives, Gary Stern, also demanded that Donald Trump return the classified files from Mar-a-Lago in a letter in 2021. It is also our understanding that roughly 24 boxes of original presidential records were kept in the residence of the White House over the course of President Trump's last year in office and have not been transferred to the National Archives and Record Administration, despite a determination by Pat Cipollone in the final days of the administration that they need to be, Stern wrote. Throughout the year, Gary Stern continued to press Donald Trump's team to have him hand over the boxes. He even spoke with the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and three lawyers who worked in the White House's counsel's office. At the end of last year, as Gary Stern pushed for Donald Trump to return the documents, Trump told Mark Meadows that the boxes he took from the White House merely contained newspaper clippings and personal items. Even such documents seen by Trump while in office were considered presidential records, the archives informed Donald Trump's team. Still, Trump did not return any boxes. Former White House advisor Eric Hirschman also told Donald Trump near the end of his last year that he could encounter significant legal problems if he didn't return the records to the National Archives, according to the New York Times. The website truthout.org has more on the same story. In late 2021, after nearly a year of attempts from the National Archives and Records Administration to obtain government records that Donald Trump had improperly removed from the White House, the former president told his advisers that he would return the records in exchange for documents relating to the Russia investigation. Donald Trump still determined to show he had been wronged by the FBI investigation into his 2016 campaign ties to Russia, suggested to his aides that they bargain for materials related to the inquiry by offering the National Archives and Record Administration the White House records he was keeping at his estate at Mar-a-Lago, according to reporting from the New York Times. For years, Donald Trump has denounced the Russia investigation, which was led by former special counsel Robert Mueller, and sought to determine whether or not Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election on Donald Trump's behalf. Trump reportedly wanted documents from the Russia investigation because he believed that the National Archives and Record Administration had previously refused to disclose documents that would back up his unsubstantiated claims regarding the inquiry. The former president has frequently stated that the Russia investigation exonerated him of any wrongdoing. However, Robert Mueller has stated otherwise, noting that many of Donald Trump's actions could constitute obstruction of justice in the eyes of federal prosecutors. Trump's aides ultimately rejected the proposal to bargain for the documents with the National Archives and Record Administration. Later that year, Donald Trump relented and agreed to allow the National Archives and Record Administration to retrieve some documents from his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, but only after the agency threatened to get Congress involved. When the National Archives and Record Administration examined the documents it retrieved in early 2022, officials noticed that many were marked as classified, prompting them to reach out to the Department of Justice. In June of 2022, the Department of Justice subpoenaed Donald Trump to return additional documents marked as classified and had his legal counsel sign an affidavit affirming that no more documents were at Mar-a-Lago.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, criticism and admonition between friends. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, we're talking about the criticism and the admonition between friends. The relationship between friends continues for a long period of time. or even to the end of their lives. And over this period of time, they exchange their habits and morals, whether good or bad. However, committing mistakes is the nature of a human being. None of us is infallible, except those purified by the Almighty Allah. Men sometimes commit mistakes towards their Lord and towards themselves and or towards the people in their society or in the society that they're living in. Whoever has a mistake committed to him, no doubt will show his reaction, and his type of reflection differs according to the type and amount of the mistake committed, and likewise according to the person concerned. So some become angry, thereby uttering bad words, while others remain silent, as if they are unaware that a mistake has been committed. So he controls himself and continues the relationship no matter how small or big the mistake might be. Now, dealing with the mistakes of friends has its moral basis. Because when a friend commits a mistake to his friend, for instance, he directed a bad word to him. For instance, let's say, for example, a friend has directed a bad word to the other particular friend, or maybe has cheated him financially or socially. He should approach him mildly for his mistake, because exercising patience from natural mistakes of others is a major basis in a friend's life. Whoever is not able to accommodate others' mistakes automatically can never be able to live with them. But whoever crosses the limit of good morals, inflicting harm to his friend, then it is not right to take him as a friend. So one of the main things that we need to look at in a relationship between two friends is for us to make sure that we are controlling how we are criticizing the other party, the other side of our friendship.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzam. We're talking about the criticism between friends. Criticizing and following a friend if he or she makes a mistake is not something bad. Rather, it is obligatory, it is wajib, in order to correct him so that the relationship can continue. But it is wrong to admonish your friend in all matters, or maybe to criticize him to the extent of you hurting his feelings. We must respect the feelings of our friends and present criticism in a word acceptable to them. So if we want our friend to accept our criticism, we must also accept his criticism and admonition. And we should open our hearts and mind to accept it. Because man, definitely, most of the time he commits mistakes. But sensible criticism helps in correcting and wiping out the mistakes, as well as adjusting him. So we need to control how we are criticizing others, how we are speaking to them, how it's going to make them feel whenever we say a few words in form of criticizing. And this might definitely improve the relationship between two friends. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are with you. What about you?
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Some people feel happy when they pray alone. Instead of 17 rak'ah a day, they offer 51 rak'at a day, not to mention other recommended prayers. Someone tells them, people are leaving the religion in droves. This does not concern them. As Sa'adi says, they pull their own rug back from the wave. They say, it's hard enough to save ourselves, let alone anyone else. Some people think this way, but the kind of action that is a mark of faith is not this. Anyone who prays well but prays by themselves without any concern for the prayers of others, this is not correct. It is not, as we said, complete. What is the mark of true faith? Maintaining the prayer. Maintaining it by praying in a community, by making everyone worshippers, although not necessarily in the sense that everyone worships together. I want you to think beyond the words. I want you to think more broadly. Words are too small to express this. This doesn't mean that we make the person who doesn't pray say his prayers. It means making a community which prays, a community which is always mindful of Allah and is always following the path of Allah. A community which says, you alone we worship and your aid alone we seek. The Quran, Surah 1, verse 5.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A community that only worships and serves Allah, and a community that relies on no one except Allah. A prayerful community means one which in its daily life distances itself from the leaders of corruption, those upon whom is Allah's wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ, and those who follow corruption, those who are astray, ضَالِّينَ, the Quran, Surah 1, verse 7. This is what prayer means. If someone tries to make other people prayerful in this sense, this is a mission done in the service of the truth, for the sake of removing corruption, for the sake of removing us and them, for the sake of the unity of a society and the unity of all human beings. This is what it means to maintain the prayer. In other words, you do something so that everyone, five times every day, will repeat the words, "You alone we worship and your aid alone we seek. Allah, we only serve you. We only bend to you and to no one else." Five times every day, they will disassociate from those who have incurred your wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ, and those who are astray, ضَالِّينَ, from the leaders of corruption and the followers of corruption.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
The consequences of Europe's submission to the US dictates are being felt deeply these days as European households are grappling with soaring energy prices and high inflation rates. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, "Berlin must act quickly and drastically to avoid hospital closures," the health minister has warned. Many hospitals in Germany may be forced into bankruptcy due to soaring energy prices and inflation unless the federal government comes up with some form of assistance, Health Minister Karl Lauterbach said recently. He said, if we do not react quickly and really drastically, there will be closures. The German Hospital Federation complained last week that the funding gap could add up to around 15 billion euros in 2022 and 2023, but the health minister brushed aside that estimate, saying that no one can predict how expensive electricity will be next year. The Federation, however, said that extra energy costs account for just about a third of that sum, while the rest of it was non-refinanced increases in material costs due to soaring inflation. The health chief is set to meet Finance Minister Christian Lindner to discuss potential forms of assistance the government can provide, but has for now ruled out creating a specialized federal fund to help keep the healthcare facilities afloat. The hospitals are in a very special situation, he said, adding, but we cannot create separate special funds for each sphere. Annual inflation in Germany continues to rise by double digits, accelerating to 10.9% in September. Finalized data from the Federal Statistical Office showed recently. The inflation rate has reached an all-time high since German reunification, the Stasi president George Thiel said, citing enormous price rises for energy products as well as food costs as the main reasons for the high inflation. Leading German economies have recently warned that the skyrocketing gas prices could push the EU's largest economy into recession. They forecast that Germany will be among the countries worst affected by the global economic slowdown next year. The EU is currently struggling with a severe energy crisis, with gas prices hitting record levels, driving up overall inflation. Russia once covered over 40% of the EU's gas needs prior to the start of its military operation in Ukraine and the ensuing sanctions. Supplies have dropped dramatically this year, exacerbating the energy crisis as the bloc seeks to reduce its dependence on Russian energy and punish Moscow. German energy giant EnBW AG announced recently that gas prices for households will rise again by an average 38% starting on December 1st. The announcement comes around 3 months after the previous increase went into effect. Also, Anadolu website reported the incidence of bankruptcy claims filed by companies and partnerships in Germany have increased by 34% to 762 year-on-year in September, exceeding forecast, the Economic Research Institute IWH said recently. The institute has predicted a rise of 25% a month ago for September, it added. Stephen Muller, a director at the institute, said there will be visible increases in bankruptcies in the coming month. For October, IWH's leading indicators signal for a one-third more bankruptcies annually. While in November, even a 40% level can be exceeded, he noted. In addition to the seriously deteriorating economic situation, bankruptcies stemmed from a sharp increase in prices of important factors of production, Muller said. While the European Central Bank's interest rate hikes raised the financing costs for companies, the increased average wage per hour from 10.45 euros to 12 euros as of October added new costs to firms' budgets. The rises in energy prices related to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine crisis have also adversely affected the cost. Also, AFP reported massive crowds of protesters took to the streets of Paris recently to voice discontent over the rising cost of living. It comes as the country's largest trade union continues a refinery strike that has closed gas stations across the country. The protest was organized by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former presidential candidate and leader of the left-wing France Unbound party. A number of other leftist parties and organizations participated, with some calling on President Emmanuel Macron to take a stronger action against climate change. However, economic concerns are first and foremost on the minds of protesters. It's not the march of Mr. Mélenchon, the LFI leader told France 3 TV, adding, it's a march of the people who are hungry, who are cold, and who want to be better paid. The rise in prices is unbearable, LFI deputy Manon Aubry told AFP, adding, it is the greatest loss of purchasing power in 40 years. France's inflation rate currently stands at 6%, while almost all of the country's industrial sectors have recorded a drop in activity due to rising energy costs, largely a result of the EU's sanctioning of Russian fossil fuels following the launch of Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. With household energy bills soaring, firewood is once again in demand in France, and power outages have been forecast. Clashes between far-left radicals, a regular fixture at French protests, and police officers were reported, with riot police firing tear gas to subdue the black-clad rioters. Amid the protests, France's CGT trade union is continuing strikes at oil refineries, demanding pay rises for workers. The strikes, which have been ongoing for 3 weeks, have caused shortages and rationing at gas stations. GCT said recently that it rejected a pay offer from oil giant Total Energies.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Poreza, London.
The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it, and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process, and we're cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open three schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats, one of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rebeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rebeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The four Geneva Conventions, especially the third Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf War.